The New Covenant.
There is so much to be said on this subject from the standpoint of the Bible that it's hard to know where to start and where to stop. I'm not sure what the committee had in mind when they wanted me to speak on it, but I thought this afternoon, in the very limited time that we have, to just deal with a couple of pictures or prophecies in picture which the Lord has given us, which I think explain quite a lot about the New Covenant, not only the time setting of the New Covenant, but particularly the relationship of a New Covenant with an Old Covenant. At the outset, I would like to say that if we were picking or choosing illustrations or symbolisms to describe a covenant, we probably would pick some sort of an illustration that would have very legal aspects to it. Something which would emphasize the fact that one party has a responsibility to another party from a very legal point of view, sort of amplifying the idea of justice. That's usually how we think of covenants today, isn't it? The word is hardly ever used outside of legal language today. And of course it does have that aspect and that definition. But interestingly enough, when the Lord tried to find an illustration, or did find an illustration, he chose one that doesn't really amplify that aspect of it so much. He chose the illustration of marriage, a husband and wife. Now we know that in that kind of a contract or covenant, as it were, that a lot more is exemplified than that of just a cut-and-dried contract, isn't it? We usually think of love as connected with marriage. And all of the very fine, tender feelings that go with the union of a man and a woman in marriage. Their respect for one another, and their concern for one another, their faithfulness and fidelity to one another. And all of these things the Lord intended to be expressed in the illustration that he used. And of course, in these illustrations, he is pictured as the husband. We know that that was true in the main illustration that he gave us in the life of Abraham, that Abraham and his wives represented various features of his plan related to covenants. And we know that Sarah, as the Apostle Paul points out, was a covenant arrangement that didn't require a mediator, because it was a covenant that was based on all of these fine, high qualities that God exemplified in this expression of covenant through marriage. And of course, Sarah represented a covenant that brings forth a seed. And the Apostle Paul elaborates on that at quite some length in the book of Galatians, as we know. And we're not really going to consider too much of the book of Galatians today. Another covenant that was represented in Abraham's life was through the handmaid of Sarah, which was Hagar, as a result of a long waiting for the seed to be produced through Sarah, and in that long wait, an alternate course of action to bring forth a seed was devised by Sarah and her handmaid, and Abraham, of course, allowed it to happen, and he took her handmaid to marriage and brought forth a child, Ishmael, who Paul points out represented the nation of Israel. But there was another wife in the life of Abraham that some tend to discount as having any typical significance, due to the fact that in the book of Galatians, the Apostle Paul doesn't refer to her at all. But I don't think that should necessarily be a good argument for not accepting Hagar as part of this picture, or the type that the Lord was making here, of a reality that was to happen on a much grander scale. We don't use that particular logic with other types, do we? For instance, the tabernacle itself, which is probably the most elaborate type that we have in the Bible, and the Apostle Paul elaborates on the tabernacle as a type in the book of Hebrews. But we find that he doesn't really apply very much of the various features of the tabernacle in a typical sense. I think there are really only 12 features of the tabernacle, including some of the sacrifices, which he actually explains in a typical sense. And yet we know there are many more. For instance, I'll just take the matter of the court of the tabernacle itself. The court of the tabernacle is not mentioned in the book of Hebrews. Some of the activities that took place in the court are mentioned. Of course, the slaying of sacrifices on the Day of Atonement and so on. But the court itself, as we know, is a very vital feature of the type, of the picture of the tabernacle, explaining human justification. But it's not mentioned. There are certain things that are mentioned. The compartments of the tabernacle itself, only one of them is explained as a type, and that was the most holy, which Paul says represents heaven itself. But the holy, that was the most holy, but the holy of the tabernacle is not explained, and the court is not explained. And yet, we know we accept them as typical, because the most holy wouldn't really have a valid typical significance unless we could understand the two. Or we can understand the other two as a result of understanding what the most holy represents. And so, the Lord gives us just enough information to verify the fact that these are types, and just enough information so that with logic and rationalization we can determine what the other features of the type represent. And I think that's probably true in the life and the picture that he was making through Abraham. After all, he wasn't dealing with a situation that involved a covenant or covenants that were pictured other than by Sarah and Hagar at that point. It was a matter of a confusion in the minds of the early Christians as a result of the Jewish expectation that the covenant, the law covenant, we could say the old law covenant, because we're supposed to be talking about the new one this afternoon, that would be the means by which the Lord would bring forth the seed. And he's trying to enlighten them to the fact that the Lord didn't intend to bring forth a seed through that covenant arrangement, that the seed was going to be brought through another arrangement which was unique and which was represented in Sarah herself. Any further part of this picture wasn't valid to the subject that he was addressing, because the new covenant was future. But we do know that, as it's explained to us in the 25th chapter of Genesis, that after Sarah had died, and after Isaac and Rebekah, who were all part of this picture, Isaac representing the Christ, and the completion of that with the union of Rebekah, after all of that was completed, then Abraham took another wife, and her name was Keturah. And it's stated simply in the 25th chapter of Genesis this way. It says, "Then again Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah. And she bare him Zimram, and Jokshan, and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shuah." Now this statement here seems to give the thought that these were all brought forth after Abraham, after Sarah was dead, and Abraham married Keturah again. Or married Keturah, took her for a wife is the expression here. But we find in other places in the Scriptures, particularly in the New Testament, and Paul's treatise of this, that this couldn't possibly be true. For instance, in Romans, the fourth chapter of Romans, and again in Hebrews, Paul says this about the bringing forth of Isaac. He says that at the time that Isaac was brought forth, which naturally would have to precede the bringing forth of these six children of Keturah, if they were brought forth after Sarah died. He says that in the 19th verse, talking about Abraham and the bringing forth of Isaac, who preceded them, and being not weak in faith, he considered not his own body, now dead, when he was about 100 years old, neither yet the deadness of Sarah's womb. He staggered not at the promise of God through unbelief, but was strong in faith, giving glory to God. So here he points out that at this point in time, Abraham was too old to bear children. And he says that Sarah had been barren, and there was no reason to expect that she wouldn't continue that way the rest of her life. The Apostle Paul, again in Hebrews, the 11th chapter and the 11th and 12th verses, has this to say. He says, through faith, Sarah herself received strength to conceive seed. He says that it was that the Lord made special arrangements for her to be able to bear a child. She had been barren her entire life, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who was promised. In other words, Isaac was, in a sense, a miracle child. He says concerning Abraham in the 12th verse, he says, therefore sprang there even one, and him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky and multitude, and the sand which is by the sea, and so on. So here he points out that neither Abraham or Sarah were of the childbearing age. And the Lord waited this long period of time. When he first told them they were going to have a child, why, it was 25 years earlier, and yet he allowed it, the promise to extend over a 25-year period, to the point where it was quite obvious that they couldn't bring forth children, and that the child that was brought forth in Isaac, in the person of Isaac, was in fact a miracle. That the Lord provided the power for which that to take place. And of course we know that that was a very apt situation or illustration of the fact that Jesus himself, who was the antitypical Isaac, was brought forth through the power of God. Old Mary says that the whole Spirit of God, he said, would overshadow her, and that would be the means by which she would bring forth a child. And then, of course, extending it on down to the entire Christ, as Paul says, if ye be Christ, then are ye Abraham's seed, and heirs according to the promise. And he says, we, brethren, as Isaac were, are children of the promise. The spiritual seed that's brought forth is brought forth through the power of the Holy Spirit. We use the word begetting. The Apostle Paul uses the word begetting. He's saying that we are begotten by the Holy Spirit of God. And so this was all pictured in the life of Abraham in this very unique way of having them bring forth a child beyond the time when it was possible for them through natural course to bring forth a child. And so we would have to believe that these children of Keturah must have been brought forth before Isaac, or at least before while Abraham was still able to have children. And we find that that's probably true. We notice here that a little later on, I think in the 6th verse, it says, but the sons of the concubines. It was common for men to have concubines in those days, which Abraham had. Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac, his son, while he yet lived eastward in the east country. But this is after it says that they became children of Abraham. We have a confirmation of that in Chronicles, where, I think it's Chronicles 132, where it mentions that Keturah was a concubine again when she brought forth these children. And that's 1 Chronicles 132. Now the sons of Keturah, Abraham's concubine, and she bare, so on, it's the same names as we read in Genesis 25:2. She was a concubine at the time she brought these forth. She was not a wife. And, of course, they had these various standings, you might say, of relationship to a husband. Concubines, the children of concubines, had no inheritance from their father. And so these children didn't stand to have any inheritance at all. But after Sarah was dead and gone, and Abraham took another wife, he chose one of his concubines. He chose Keturah. And when he chose Keturah and made her a legal wife, why then her children, the standing of her children, were raised to that of sons. Not the privileged son that Isaac was. He was a special son. He was a seed of promise. But they were nevertheless raised to the level of sons. And that, I think, makes a beautiful, very valid picture of the reality of those who will be the children of the new covenant arrangement, which we believe Keturah represented in this case. They're not brought forth under the new covenant. They've preceded the new covenant as far as they're being brought forth. They've been brought forth ever since the children of Adam began to be born into sin and shapen in iniquity. But they've been brought forth on this earth. They've been brought forth under a condemned condition, having no inheritance, in life itself. And yet, there comes a time when, under the new covenant arrangement, when they receive an inheritance. It wipes away the condemnation, that is the method of salvation that the Lord has used, when it is applied under the new covenant arrangement, wipes away the original condemnation, and they have the privileges of becoming the children of God, back into personal relationship with God, the same relationship that Adam had before he sinned. And that's the reason why the Bible calls it restitution. So this is one picture that we have, and of course he used the very tender, loving relationship that exists between a man and wife to depict this. And of course we know that God has that same feeling, even towards his children who have sinned, even those that are out of the way. Jesus' statement on the matter was that God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten Son, that whosoever believeth on him should not perish, but have everlasting life. And we know that opportunity for the world of mankind in general will have to wait for the millennial age. The scriptures are quite clear on that. There's another picture that I want to get to. And it uses, and the reason I'm using this is because it, again, uses a husband and wife situation to depict a covenant. But here, particularly, the relationship of the old covenant, the old Jewish law covenant, which, as we know, the Lord had finally brought to an end because of its failure to produce what the Lord had intended to be produced through his covenant. And this was more or less exemplified and amplified in the life of Hosea himself. And it's recorded beginning in the first chapter of Hosea. And Hosea was instructed by the Lord to go take a wife. But it's interesting that he says, take a wife of whoredoms and children of whoredoms. And some have questioned why the Lord would condone and even suggest that a prophet, one who represented him, would take one wife, a woman who was involved in an impure life. Well, when we read this carefully, we find that that wasn't the case. It's a prophecy of what was going to happen, and did happen as the prophecy goes on here. And he relates it right off to Israel nationally, through whom he had made a covenant. And Israel nationally, in this whole picture here, represented the mother feature of this covenant, the wife, rather, of this covenant. And he says, for the land hath committed great whoredoms, departing from the Lord. And so he makes a connection right away with Gomer, who was the name of this woman, and what she represented. So he went and took Gomer, the daughter of Diblaim, which conceived and bare him a son. Now that's the first record of her having brought forth any children. Later, in the second chapter, it tells us about children. First chapter tells us about children that she brought forth to Hosea. What happened with Israel were represented in these children. What happened to Israel down through the course of their history in this covenant relation through this marriage? And the second chapter is an indictment expresses the fact that Gomer brought forth children which are not Hosea's, and the indictment against her. And he points out that this is what Israel, in fact, had done under that law covenant. And so he sort of outlines Israel's history here, the high points of it. And the first child that was brought forth was named Jezreel. And Jezreel, it's interesting what that name means, because he says he named him Jezreel so he could avenge the blood of Jezreel upon the house of Jehu, which of course represented the 10-tribe kingdom of Israel at that time. Jezreel means to sow. And that was the original purpose of the covenant, wasn't it? It started out pure, just as Gomer was a pure woman when she was married. The Jewish arrangement started out pure. The commandments as they were given at Sinai through a mediator like Moses was a pure arrangement. It was an arrangement which they couldn't keep, which the Lord knew they couldn't keep, and made alternate arrangements so that in a typical way it could remain with them year after year through the tabernacle and through the priests and that sort of thing. But it started out, the purpose of God, express purpose of God, was that it might sow. It was to carry out part of the word that he gave to Abraham that his seed would be as the sands of the seashore and so on. When we read this, he says that at this particular point in history, this first child or this first experience under the law covenant was to avenge the blood of Jezreel, that this purpose of God was not being carried out. And so it marks the time when, as far as Israel was concerned, he brought their polity to an end. The 10-tribe kingdoms went into captivity and disappeared into Gentile lands. The next child that was brought forth, and I'm not going to try to pronounce it, but he interprets here exactly what the word means. In the sixth verse, he says, he named her that because he says, I will no more have mercy upon the house of Israel, but I will utterly take them away. Now, the first one, he was destroyed. But the second one, he says, utterly take away. What remained of Israel's identity was the two-tribe kingdom. And, of course, he did. He utterly took them away, didn't he? He brought, finally, for the same reasons, for the fact of their propensity to go into idolatry and not to be faithful to the Lord and to their responsibilities to that covenant, he took them away. But the next verse says, I will utterly take them away, but I will have mercy upon the house of Judah and will save them by the Lord their God and will not save them by bow nor sword nor battle nor horses and so on. And so in other words, they couldn't extract themselves from their captivity, but at the end of the 70 years, as he had promised, the Lord brought them back by working his will in the minds of the king of the land in which they had been enslaved. But at that time, it was the Medo-Persian kingdom. And so he brought them back, but there came a time when the Lord gave them another opportunity. Several centuries it intervened, in which they had an opportunity to again show their allegiance to that arrangement, that covenant arrangement, but they failed. And so this situation, this union of Hosea and Gomer, brought forth another child. And the Lord's expression of that is, the word was Loami, for ye are not my people, I will not be your God. In other words, he was going to cut them off completely. The covenant relationship was ending. And of course, the second chapter indicates that's what happened. There was a divorce that took place. And yet he says, even with this, and of course we know that happened at the time of our Lord. He expressed it in the terms of, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, how often would I have gathered thee as a hen gathers the chicks, but ye would not. Behold, your house is left unto you desolate. And that covenant arrangement came to an end. He was no longer their God, and they were no longer his people. And yet he says that God, looking down in the future, was not going to allow his purpose in this whole arrangement, even though Israel didn't live up to their responsibilities, it didn't bring forth God's purpose, it was going to be accomplished nevertheless. And you know that's what the word Gomer means. It means completion. It was yet to be completed at a later time. And the 10th and 11th verse indicate that this was still God's purpose. Yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sands of the sea, which cannot be measured nor numbered. And it shall come to pass that in the place where it is said unto them, ye are not my people. He cut them off. He says, it's not going to be said anymore. A change will come. There it shall be said unto them, ye are the sons of the living God. Then it would have fulfilled its purpose when it can be said, ye are the sons of the living God, because it indicates that they have been brought back into harmony with God and his arrangements as sons. Then shall the children of Judah and children of Israel be gathered together and appoint themselves one head, and they shall come up out of the land, for great shall be the day of Jezreel. In other words, God's purpose was going to be, he was not going to allow his purpose to be thwarted by their infidelity to that arrangement, but the great day that would accomplish the sowing purpose, that is, sowing to bring forth sons of God in the earth, was going to be accomplished. Now, of course, the second chapter goes on to indicate that children are brought forth which were not the sons of Hosea, and he goes on and expresses the indictment against Gomer, and in fact was an indictment against Israel under the law. And he tells about all the wonderful arrangements that he had, but that they didn't attribute to the Lord, and they didn't appreciate, and how he was going to take them away. And 10th verse, he says, now I will, at this particular point, when he is going to, he brings on this indictment, and he cuts them off. They're no longer his people. He says, now I will discover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and then shall deliver her out of my hand. And that's what was true. The whole failure of Israel was exposed by Jesus and exposed by the Apostle Paul greatly in his writings right here in the book. She was discovered. It was now made manifest. And of course, God had documented all of this quite carefully throughout the Old Testament in order that as Zechariah's prophecy, yes, it would be carried out. It says, like as I have made you an example of a curse, I will make you an example of a blessing. That whole arrangement was to show how that a people who had a very good beginning, they were the children of Abraham. You couldn't find from a genetic point of view, you couldn't find a more faithful man in the Bible than Abraham, and yet his children and his children's children, when God, it came time to make covenant with them, why it was impossible for them to fulfill that arrangement. And then not only that, it wasn't just a matter of not being able to keep it. The Lord knew that, and then he made arrangements whereby that could be offset and overlooked by the annual giving of Atonement Day sacrifices and so on, and doing away with their sins, overlooking their sins, and reestablishing their covenant relationship. But even that, Jesus pointed out how that they had distorted that law so much from the purity of its purpose and principle as it was expressed at Sinai and in God's ramifications of it through Moses, so that they had brought in what Jesus called the tradition of the fathers and made them more important than the high principles of the law. And so all of this was now revealed by Jesus and later by the apostles. He says, I will cause all her mirth to cease, and her feast days, and her new moons, and her Sabbath, and all her solemn feasts. All of these things disappeared. They were all part of the law. But he says that this law concept, as it was represented in Israel nationally, was now being destroyed. And he says, I will destroy her vines and her fig trees. Well, the vine and the fig tree represented the security to those who would come under that arrangement. But it was going to end. The same as all of the ceremonies that existed with that law. We're now coming to an end. Her feasts, her new moons, her Sabbaths, her solemn feasts. And he says, I will visit upon her the days of Balaam. Balaam is a reference to the idolatry that she fell into and was generally expressed that entire period of time. Of course, the Lord again emphasizes the idea of a double arrangement for the for her punishment for her sins in Isaiah 40. It talks about the time when the punishment was over, and he says that he had punished her double for her sins. And so he will visit upon them, beginning with the ending of our Lord's first advent until very recent times, the days of Balaam, a time of punishment. Of course, that came upon them nationally, not necessarily individually, although they suffered as individuals, the national punishment that came upon them throughout the gospel age. But then he says that after the days of Balaam have ended, after this, the Lord had dealt with their punishment, as it were, he'll begin to allure her again. He'll begin to allure the same woman that he had divorced. We know he had divorced her because in the second chapter, he tells about how Israel would plead for their mother, the covenant, and how they would refuse to recognize the fact that the covenant was ended, that their divorcement had taken place. He says, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. Better, therefore, put away her whoredoms out of her sight, and so on. In other words, he said that there was an opportunity for them to receive his favor again, and maybe to be considered to be brought back into a marriage relationship with him if she would change her ways. And so the whole gospel age experience was to set the foundation for an opportunity to change her ways. And we'll see how when the millennial age begins, how that this will all become clear. They'll be able to focus in on what this experience meant and be able to make the proper relationship between the example that was set under the first covenant and what God expects from the second covenant. And he says that at that time he would begin to allure her. Well, we know there have been motions made to bring Israel back into national status again, not necessarily in the favor of the Lord, but at least national identity among the nations. Bring her into the wilderness. The wilderness was always pictured a condition where the Lord was guiding and directing certain circumstances of certain people, but they weren't aware of the objective. And we find that that's true in many places in the Bible where he talks about a wilderness condition. And Israel has been brought back into a wilderness condition. And speak comfortably to her. There's a certain amount of hope that began to be renewed as far as that nation was concerned. And of course, Isaiah's prophecy emphasized the fact that there would be an explanation of this at the end of the age, which would tend to be a comfort to Israel if they would listen. Comfort ye, my people. And of course, he points out how that he would give her vineyards from thence and the valley of Achor for a door of hope. In other words, there would be a reestablishment of the land, and they would be reestablished in the land, but it would be a troublesome experience for them. Achor means trouble. And shall be in that day, saith the Lord, that thou shalt call me Ishai, which means husband. In other words, they're thinking in terms again of maybe their covenant relationship with God. For I will take away the name of Balaam out of her mouth, and they shall no more be remembered by their name. And then you get to the 18th verse, and he says, and in that day I will make a covenant for them. And listen to this, with the beasts of the field, with the fowls of heaven, and with the creeping things of the ground. Now, where have we heard that before? That's the expression of the covenant that he made with Adam, wasn't it? He gave him dominion over the beasts of the field, the fowl of the air, and over every creepy thing that creepeth upon the earth. And so the reason that this new covenant, in other words, he's making a new covenant with the same people, with the same entity, not the same people, but the same entity, national Israel, who in terms of this picture, represented the covenant, that he's going to make a new covenant. It's not the old. It's a new covenant, but with the same people, with Israel. But it involves more than just Israel, doesn't it? Israel pictured the world, and in the new covenant arrangement, while it's made with Israel, it's intended to have all of the world proselyted into this new covenant arrangement. I will make a new covenant for them, and it will be a restoration of what God had purposed for man and given man in the person of Adam right from the very beginning. And so we find here what the purpose of the new covenant is. The new covenant is a time of restitution, as Peter said, of all things which God hath spoken by the mouth of all his holy prophets since the world began. And he goes on, he says, I'll both break the bow and the sword and the battle out of the earth, and will make them lie down safely. Well, Adam had this kind of safety in the beginning, didn't he? That's going to be restored. Other prophecies that deal with this time says he'll make wars to cease unto the ends of the earth. They'll beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. That's something that the new covenant will establish in the earth. And I will betroth thee unto me forever. It's a remarriage with Israel, but now Israel, in the larger picture, is the world. He betroths them forever. So the covenant is an everlasting covenant that he makes with the world. And that word is used many times in the Old Testament concerning God's dealings, the length of the dealings that he's going to have with man. And he says, "Now I will betroth thee unto me in righteousness." I'll start out that way in the from God's point of view, the first time, didn't it? But not from Israel's point of view. And in judgment, and in loving kindness, and in mercies. What a nice picture marriage is of a covenant. And think of all the wonderful principles that will be involved in the new covenant arrangement, which God will express to man, and which man will have to learn to reciprocate and express to God. I will even betroth thee unto me in faithfulness. Never again will they draw away from God in infidelity and unfaithfulness, into sin, into idolatry, and that sort of thing. And thou shalt know the Lord. That will be the one advantage that they'll have that Israel didn't. Well, there were other advantages, but this is one of the advantages, that they'll get to know the Lord as he truly is. The old covenant really didn't express God that way, did it? And it says, and it shall come to pass in that day, and here it tells us about the arrangement of that covenant. And, of course, this explains God's intervening work, preparing for that covenant. And it shall come to pass in that day, when he betroths Gomer again, as it were, I will hear, saith the Lord, I will hear the heavens. That's the spiritual phase of the kingdom. What he's been developing down through the gospel age, spiritual Israel, the heavenly phase of the kingdom, he will hear. That's how his word will go forth. Through those that have been prepared to administer the work, the mediatorial work of the kingdom, Christ and his church, the seed of promise, which was promised to Abraham, was said to Abraham, would bless all the families of the earth. And they shall hear the earth. They'll be in contact with the earthly representatives of that kingdom who Paul pointed out and Jesus pointed out in a more indirect way that God had selected from Israel and from all of the ancient peoples, even preceding Israel, which we call, he refers to as the ancient prophets. We refer to them as the ancient worthies. Paul describes their lives and their faithfulness in the 11th chapter of Hebrews, and there were many more, he said, who that phase of it had already been prepared. They shall hear the earth. And the earth, what will they be concerned with? Why, the interests of the people, how the people react to this new arrangement. They shall hear the corn and the wine and the oil. That's, of course, symbolic expressions for the truth as the people will receive it and the wonderful blessings of the kingdom and how it will change their hearts and their minds to be in tune with God as Adam's was. And they, shall hear Jezreel. That purpose will be the ultimate purpose in the minds of everyone who is connected with the kingdom arrangement. Restoration of God's purpose on the earth. And that's what Jezreel meant, wasn't it? Sowing of life to man and the restoration of life to the generations from that point on. And he says, I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy on her that hath not obtained mercy, and I will say unto them which were not my people, thou art my people, and they shall say, thou art my God. And so here we find an expression of restitution. Now, I'm going to read very quickly because I don't have time to discuss any of it, but I can't have a discussion of the New Covenant without reading the text which deals with the New Covenant in the most direct way. And that's in the 34th chapter of Jeremiah. And you must remember that the 30th and the 31st chapters of Jeremiah are really one prophecy. And the stage is set for this prophecy at the time when Israel is restored to her land and regains her identity among the nations. And it's referred to this way at the beginning of the prophecy. It says, for lo, the day come, saith the Lord, that I'll bring again the captivity of my people Israel and Judah, saith the Lord, and I will cause them to return to the land that I gave to their fathers, and they shall possess it. Now, the word possess is the key word. It means ownership. At the time that Jeremiah was writing this was in that interim period between the first time that the Chaldean powers had come against them and taken some of their people captive and made them a subject nation until the time when Nebuchadnezzar came some 21 years later and took them, most of the nation, captive and ended their identity as a nation, even a subject nation. But he was writing this in that interim period where they no longer possessed their land. And after they came back from the 70 years captivity, they didn't possess their land. They were subject nation to Gentile powers until when? 1948. They again gained their identity as a nation among the nations and possessed their land, at least part of it. And so he goes on to describe in this prophecy several things that would happen as a result, and equated to the restoration of Israel to the ownership of their land. And one of those things was that a new covenant would be made. And it reads like this, 31st verse. Behold, the day comes, saith the Lord, that I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and with the house of Judah. That's the remarriage of the pictorial Hosea to Gomer. Not according to the covenant that I made with their fathers in the day that I took them by the hand and bring them out of the land of Egypt, which my covenant they break, although I was an husband unto them, saith the Lord. He says this arrangement is going to be based on a much firmer foundation than that one was. But this shall be the covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, saith the Lord. I will put my law in their inward parts and write it in their hearts, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Now, the tool that Moses used, which the Lord gave him to write the law and to educate the people of Israel under that old law, was tables of stone. But Paul, in the third chapter of 1 Corinthians, makes a wonderful analogy of this. And he says that connection with the new covenant, that he's not writing his law in tables of stone. He's writing his law in the tables of the heart, with the Holy Spirit of God.